Many thanks to Andreas for the kind introduction and for inviting me to share my work in this context. My talk will cover 4 points. I will begin with outlining the significance of postcolonial critique for philosophy, to then focus on historical aspect of philosophical reflections on the human, which reinforced racist and imperialist normative violence. In a third step, I'll address the relation between cosmopolitan humanitarianism and neocolonialism, and conclude with the challenge of decolonization. So part one. At the turn of the 20th century, Europe ruled over 85% of the global territories in the form of colonies, protectorates, and dependencies. The colonial expansion was an extensive violent process which was marked by exploitation, genocide, and suppression. It doesn't require a lot of imagination to understand that such massive territorial domination, which was coercively imposed and maintained over centuries, was not possible only through military might, and moreover, will not disappear merely through the formal transfer of power to native elites. Colonialism has not only left its traces on those who have been colonized, but also on the other side of the colonial divide, namely the global north. Postcolonial studies may be understood as an effort to understand this complex process, even as they take up the challenge of contributing to the process of decolonization. Even though colonies served primarily as locations of economic exploitation, they were also the sites where the civilizing mission was operationalized with the explicit aim of producing reformed colonial subjects who would experience the European intervention as a liberating process. The term mission is extremely revealing as it points to one of the most important legitimizing strategies of the colonial discourse, which asserted itself as a necessary global process towards the greater common good of mankind. Rudyard Kipling infamously described colonialism as the white man's burden, namely the responsibility and obligation of the Europeans to save and enlighten the rest of the world. According to this logic, colonialism was not about exploitation and violence, but symbolized Western altruism, so that any form of anti-colonial resistance was perceived to be directed against the civilizing mission, namely as rejection of European virtues of rationality, progress, liberalism, sovereignty, equality, freedom, and of course, enlightenment. Thus, the construction of Europe as well as its other was at the heart of colonial politics. The postcolonial feminist Gayatri Spivak speaks of the worlding. It comes from, she's inspired by the Heideggerian concept of Welten, both the violation and the creation of the third world by colonial powers, even as colonization must be also regarded as a process of subjectification on both sides of the colonial divide, namely the production as well as subjection of individuals, a la Michel Foucault. Accordingly, the process of decolonization goes beyond the mere transfer of power from the former colonizers to the native elites, rather entails the project of desubjugation. Spivak, following Foucault, unfolds the epistemic violence at the heart of colonial politics, namely, beside the material exploitation, postcolonial thinkers unpack how colonial epistemologies monopolize the production of knowledge, thereby delegitimizing and disqualifying non-European systems of thought. At the heart of postcolonial studies is the ambivalent negotiation with Europe as a silent referent to be critiqued, but who also ironically sometimes provides the tools for critique. As has been pointed out by postcolonial thinkers, third world theorists are obliged to refer to European intellectual tradition, but European theorists are not under any compulsion to reciprocate. The quality of their work is not compromised by their relative ignorance of non-Western perspectives. This asymmetrical ignorance is a sign of the unequal relations between the global North and the South as a historical product of colonialism. One of the best examples of this is to be found in the most influential history of a non-European society, namely James Mill's History of British India. Mill, who never put a foot in India and did not speak any Indian languages, argued that he was particularly qualified to write the history of India precisely because of his lack of direct acquaintance with India. He claimed to possess a judgment, so he claimed he was objective and neutral because his contact with India was untainted by any unmediated contact with the natives and its civilization, unlike his opponents, the Orientalists, who had gone native. If Europe universalized itself through colonialism, then decolonization is inextricably linked to the project of de-universalizing Europe. But, and this is important to note, as Deepesh Chakravarti proposes provincializing Europe as an important aspect of the process of decolonization is not a pure rejection of European enlightenment for a nationalist or a nativist project. Rather, provincializing Europe entails the recognition of the historical fact that modernity is deeply linked to European imperialism. Thus, even as the project of modernity produces the Third World, Europe, or produced the Third World, Europe and Homo Europaeus too was made by its imperial projects. At the same time, modernity is not just a European accomplishment, rather the rest of the world equally contributed to it and consequently has a stake in it. The dilemma that the postcolonial theorist faces is how to provincialize Europe when academic disciplines like history, philosophy, political science, sociology, ethnology are informed by European disciplinary hegemony. It is plausible to argue that Europe does not have a monopoly on knowledge production, as knowledge is produced everywhere. But the problem is that subaltern knowledges are silenced within the hegemonic site of modern epistemology. This makes the much celebrated plea for provincializing Europe a necessary but impossible undertaking in face of the fact that European intellectual tradition is at once both indispensable and inadequate for the rest of the world. The other important question that is rarely addressed is, who will provincialize Europe? Who has the resources and the ability to negotiate the hegemony of the European intellectual tradition? Given that academic disciplines are not only Eurocentric, but also Androcentric, where does the postcolonial feminist scholarship stand vis-a-vis the project of decolonization of the mind? This brings me to the second part of my presentation. It's titled Empire and Dehumanization. As has been pointed out by postcolonial theorists, Europe is imagined as the site of secular modernity, with the East being the realm of eternal religion, tradition, and despotism. The authoritarian irrationality of the Orient was seen as a sign of its backwardness, Oriental despotism, and immoral feudalism, which proved that it occupied a lower stage in the evolution of modernity. Eastern political systems were seen to deny the possibility of rationality and freedom, and thus the development of individuality. In contrast, Europe is clearly the site of secular history, freed from the shackle of tradition with the supposed restricted influence of institutionalized religion. All the Orient can do is follow Europe's example. Notions of progress, liberty, tolerance, democracy, civil society, and public sphere converge in the all-embracing civilization thesis. It was argued that some societies are at a lower stage of evolution and have to be educated like children to make them capable of enjoying freedom. Belief in the evolutionary difference between metropole and colony made it possible for a thinker like John Stuart Mill to be a radical advocate of freedom, even as he endorsed enlightened, progressive imperialism. His view allowed him to claim freedom at home and support despotism in the colony. The legitimization strategy of colonialism as a civilizing mission and the dynamic of difference between civilized and uncivilized barbaric conceded the possibility of becoming civilized. So the barbarians could become civilized, but of course, guidance by the Europeans is necessary. This is the infamous colonial pedagogic project of helping backward societies to overcome their civilizational infantilism. The political incompetence of the colonized can be corrected through colonial education, which offers them the possibility of developing requisite capacities to learn to reason and thereby exercise consent, which is central to the legitimacy of political authority. And those who are not in the position to reason and exercise consent may be governed without their consent. Accordingly, certain groups of people could be justifiably excluded from the sphere of sovereignty by virtue of their not fulfilling the European norms, which were declared to be universal. Subsequently, those who possess sovereignty are then justified to dominate those who do not. As we know, this reasoning is even today employed and mobilized to legitimize Euro-American supremacy. The construction of the West as a normative power has left a trail of violent and exploitative systems in the name of modernity, progress, rationality, emancipation, rights, justice, and peace. Any non-Western individual, group, or state wanting to qualify as civilized and modern can only comply and imitate the European norms or risk the violence of being forcibly civilized and modernized against their consent. The European norms are worth emulating on the grounds of their superiority, even as the native can only attempt to be like the European, but will always fail. Thus, the attempts to imitate European norms can only produce bad, weak, or failed copies, which once again confirms the authority of the European original. Within postcolonial theory, one speaks of the paradox of modernity, whereby liberal values were preached to the colonized, however denied in practice. The Tunisian philosopher historian Hicham Chaït accuses imperialist Europe of denying its own vision of man. This echoes Frantz Fanon's call in The Wretched of the Earth. I quote, "Leave this Europe, where they are never done talking of man, yet murder men everywhere they find them. At the corner of every one of their streets, in all corners of the globe, where they never stop proclaiming that they were only anxious for the welfare of man. Today we know with what sufferings humanity has paid for every one of Europe's triumphs of the mind. Let us decide not to imitate Europe. Let us combine our muscles and our brains in a new direction. Let us try to create the whole man whom Europe has been incapable of bringing to triumphant birth." End of quote. Thus, even as European Enlightenment claimed universality and alleged to be politically inclusionary, historically the Enlightenment is deeply linked to the empire and history of violence and exclusion. It led to political disenfranchisement of people, even as it claimed to empower them. For instance, liberal political theory rests on the promise of all human beings born equal, free, and rational, and strives towards political participation and representation, universal suffrage, and self-determination. Human nature was understood to be equal by birth and yet different due to differing capacities, which justified the subjugation of some by the others who became gatekeepers to privilege. Political inclusion was contingent upon a qualified capacity to reason. This resulted in the pedagogic obsession of political philosophy and also of the empire to instruct its subjects to learn to reason. John Locke's thoughts concerning education is almost like a manual, ranging from toilet training, instructions about what should be consumed at what time of the day, how to treat servants and others of lower rank appropriately, how to control one's emotions. And this, of course, was particularly targeted for women, who were, of course, coded as hysterical. And although capacity to reason is natural, the emphasis is on how rationality must be inculcated. It is a project of breeding of civility. Education becomes a process of initiation. Although we are born free, we are really free when one learns to exercise rationality necessary for political inclusion. Reform is central to liberal political agenda. It involves the process of realignment, an impulse to better the world. Colonialism was thereby presented as a triumph of the civilized moral fruits of reason, civilized moral rational superior human that altruistically, selflessly carried the burden of bringing the fruits of reason, modernity, liberty, equality, emancipation, technology, progress, rule of law from Europe to other parts of the world. European colonizers arrogated to themselves the role of protectors and enforcers of the norms of humane and humanity, while justifying slavery, genocide, crimes against humanity on the grounds that primitive populations who were defined to be at an inferior stage of humanity threatened the moral sanctity of European civilization. It was argued that if natives wanted to qualify as human, they must adopt European practices, values, norms, and institutions. The normative violence that historically informed Eurocentric and Androcentric definitions of the human and humanity endures in the post-colonial world. Let me now turn to contemporary discourses of cosmopolitan humanitarianism and human rights to outline how these emancipatory norms continue to be inflected by neo-colonial impulses. So this brings me to the third section, cosmopolitan humanitarianism and neo-colonialism. In our current profoundly new global condition, there is a renewed interest in cosmopolitan humanitarianism as an ethico-political imperative and as a commitment to planetary conviviality in a post-national globalized world. In the face of increasing transnational circulation of capital, commodities, people, ideas, and images, cosmopolitans seem to overcome narrow territorial-based affiliations in favor of embracing the whole of humanity. Inspired by Kant and Rousseau, such an expansive conception of world citizenship has as its normative ideal the pursuit of the perfect civil union of mankind. A world citizen, a Weltbürger, acts from the pluralistic standpoint of humanity as a collective actor and not as an egoistic individual. Promoting sociality and humanity, cosmopolitanism symbolizes a transcultural or transnational competence of negotiating cultural difference, a move beyond narrow territorial understandings of identity and belonging. Irrespective of national, religious, ethnic, or gender differences, people appear as belonging to a single global community based on their shared past and entangled futures. In an increasingly globalized world, the lives of people who have never met and who possibly will never meet are nonetheless intimately connected. In Cultivating Humanity, Martha Nussbaum writes, and I quote her, "The world around us is inescapably international. Issues from business to agriculture, from human rights to the relief of famine, call our imaginations to venture beyond narrow group loyalties and to consider the reality of distant lives. Cultivating our humanity in a complex interlocking world involves understanding the ways in which common needs and aims are differently realized in different circumstances." End of quote. She argues that what all humans share and suffer can be deduced by examining a variety of self-interpretations of human beings in diverse contexts. Such an approach, according to Nussbaum, escapes the projection of local preferences in favor of a theory that is fully international and a basis of cross-cultural attunement. At first, there seems to be nothing blameworthy about this demand that we, as citizens of liberal democracies, take on responsibilities beyond the limits of our narrow self-interest, particularly in the face of growing global interdependence. Cosmopolitanism, again based on the normative espousal of an expansive global consciousness, opposes such narrow and limited territorial loyalties. To counteract the financialization of the globe, transnational citizens' movements envisage the establishment of democratic global institutions that would facilitate direct participation in a global political life. The protagonists of international civil society, indispensable to the implementation of cosmopolitan values, are seen to initiate a more just alter-globalization. The sociologist Ulrich Beck points out that because we live in an increasingly interdependent world, we face common threats to our ecologies, finances, and security, so that any violation of rights in one part of the world is felt everywhere. This globalization of risk unites us in our equal vulnerability, providing the basis for the cosmopolitan moment of the world risk society. In response to the question, how can the relationship between global risk and the creation of a global public be understood, Beck discusses what he calls a globalization of compassion. As seen in global media events such as the Haitian earthquake and the tsunamis, spectacularly demonstrated by the unprecedented readiness of citizens in faraway countries to donate to relief efforts. World Risk Society's shocking threats open up questions of social accountability and responsibility that cannot be adequately addressed either in terms of national politics or the available forms of international cooperation. According to Beck, public debate enables a range of voices to be heard and the public to participate in decisions that would otherwise evade their involvement. For Beck, international civil society actors are thus given new opportunities to intercede in the fields of human rights and global justice and in the search for a grand narrative of radical, democratic globalization. Beck endorses the cosmopolitan realpolitik, viewing global institutions such as the United Nations and the International Criminal Court, as well as global NGOs and transnational social movements such as the World Social Forum, as legitimate vanguards of global governance. International NGOs like Amnesty International and Greenpeace enjoy a high level of legitimacy in the public sphere and are increasingly entrusted with the task of globally monitoring issues of human rights and ecology. Although Nussbaum and Beck enthusiastically endorse cosmopolitan humanitarianism as a solution for past injustices and a promise for better times to come, I want to emphasize the complicities between liberal cosmopolitan articulations of solidarity and the global structures of domination they claim to resist. My discontent with the project of cosmopolitan humanitarianism is that it fails to seriously address the historical processes through which certain individuals are placed in a situation from which they can aspire to global solidarity and universal benevolence. So my argument is the world is now being divided into those who dispense justice, rights and aids, and those who are simply coded as victims and receivers of justice, rights and aids, and of course, solidarity. Nussbaum, to her credit, is trying to explore ways of improving people's life. And one might say that's a good thing, but for me, that precisely is a problem. Her attempt to act in the interests of distant others, to look beyond her position and make everyone have as good a life as ours, disregards the connection between the well-off here and the impoverished elsewhere. As Spivak has argued, Nussbaum's cosmopolitanism appears profoundly provincial in its too hasty assumption as given that the first world metropolitan academic and a third world sex subaltern subject would share fundamental interests and aims. Nussbaum firmly believes in a critical Socratic pedagogy that would circumvent Eurocentrism through cultivating sensitivity to other cultures and perspectives, even as she asserts, and I quote her, that she would rather risk charges of imperialism than refuse to take a moral stand on urgent issues facing women. End of quote. In contrast to Nussbaum's faith in cosmopolitanism's self-correctional self-reflexivity, Spivak diagnoses in the cosmopolitan call to assign ourselves with our fellow citizens a shift from the white man's burden to what she calls the burden of the fittest. This revision of social Darwinism defines the unfit, the poor, the victims of the world, as unable to either help themselves or govern themselves. The distance between those who dispense justice, aid, rights and solidarity and those who are simply coded as victims of wrongs and thus receivers remains a signature of historical violence. When progressive activists and intellectuals intervene benevolently in the struggles of subaltern groups for greater recognition and rights, they reinforce the very power relations that they seek to demolish by monopolizing agency. Conversely, Beck proposes that our common vulnerability in the face of risk brings us together. But as we know, we might be facing the same storm, but we are not all sitting in the same boat. And that makes all the difference. For Beck, tsunamis resulted in what he calls the globalization of compassion. But as an instructive contrast, I would like to consider a moment in Spivak's narrative of a major cyclone in Bangladesh in 1991 and the subsequent intervention by Doctors Without Borders. The Doctors Without Borders workers, none of whom spoke the local language, were obliged to work through interpreters. when they arrived in Bangladesh. So later, when Spivak arrived in one of the villages where she had been actively working in the past, some of the villagers ran up to her saying, in response to the help provided by the Doctor Without Borders, Doctors Without Borders, these villagers said to Spivak, I quote, "We don't want to be saved, we want to die. They're treating us like animals." End of quote. In a situation like this, and without any common language, can one even think of solidarity? For these reasons, the Sri Lankan feminist Malti De Alves has asked if we are truly capable of empathizing with the pain of others, and if we should even be allowed to witness their pain, if this witnessing is only instrumentalized once again to affirm our humanity and our capacity to care. Correspondingly, of course, we need to find authentic victims who truly deserve our benevolence. What do we do with our will to empower the disenfranchised and the vulnerable of the world? And how do we deal with those who refuse to be interpolated as appropriate objects of our solidarity? Indrapal Grewal proposes that contemporary cosmopolitan humanitarianism is an outcome of two fundamental and inextricably linked concepts, namely the liberal subject as a possessor of rights and the subject of international trade. The former emerges from the Kantian notion of the Weltbürger as citizen, as a subject of rights on a transnational scale, itself deeply linked to the subject of global economic exchange and trade. Grewal points out that even as those two cannot exist without each other, the link between the two is conveniently obliterated in celebratory discourses about cosmopolitanism. Along similar lines, Peng Chea asks whether the international division of labor is the unacknowledged but necessary condition of new cosmopolitanisms. This erasure is crucial to the production of cosmopolitan subjects in late capitalism. Historically, the cosmopolite, one who rises above narrow group loyalties to altruistically embrace the larger world, was marked as European, bourgeois, male. Discourses of new cosmopolitanism seek to rewrite the script by articulating the cosmopolitan within localized settings, creating rooted, vernacular, and lived cosmopolitanisms, arguing that contemporary transnationalism furnishes the material conditions for such new radical cosmopolitanisms that can regulate the excesses of capital globalization from below. The question remains whether these vernacular cosmopolitanisms genuinely enable those who were previously exiled from the public sphere to be heard. New cosmopolitanisms are caught between a politics that advocates the virtues of post-national cosmopolitan democracy and a kind of managerial internationalism and global moral entrepreneurship, wherein those who claim to have listened to and heard the subaltern speak do not even share a common language with her. We commonly believe that an empowered civil society automatically strengthens democracy. However, as Antonio Gramsci has taught us, civil society is itself a site where hegemony is fashioned. Elite actors in civil society obtain remarkable amounts of political power and access to transnational public spheres without being directly elected by the people whom they claim to help and to represent. For Spivak, the vanguardism of civil society actors, the organic intellectuals of global capitalism, reproduces what she calls a feudality without feudalism. The discontinuity between the givers of justice, rights and aid and the receivers, as I've already pointed out, remains a signature of historical violence. I would like to conclude now with some very, very brief reflections on the challenge of decolonization. And I would like to address the difficult question on how to negotiate the ambivalent relationship between the legacies of European enlightenment, like cosmopolitan humanitarianism and postcolonialism. And in an interesting interview titled "What is Enlightenment?", Spivak juxtaposes Kant and Foucault's essays to explore the question, what went wrong with the best of the Enlightenment? Describing the access to European enlightenment through colonization as an enabling violation, she proposes that one must strategically use this enablement even as the violation is renegotiated. So the relation of post-coloniality to the Enlightenment and its legacies of modernity, secularism, democracy, human rights, science, technology, hegemonic languages is diagnosed as a double bind, whereby Spivak advises that one should neither accuse European philosophers nor excuse them. Rather, one ought to enter the protocols of the canonical texts of the Enlightenment to see how it can be used, if turned around on its own terms, towards a more just and democratic post-coloniality. Spivak considers the post-colonial in terms of a child of a rape, a product of violence, and yet one must learn to love the child of a rape. How does the post-colonial world learn to love the legacies of European Enlightenment? She advocates the abuse of Enlightenment, not abuse, but abuse, meaning using it from below. As colonial gifts, the legacies of the Enlightenment are both present, geschenk, and poison, giftish, a la deriva. In conclusion, I propose to revisit the question that the black feminist Audre Lorde posed, namely, perhaps the master's tools can indeed be employed to dismantle the master's house. Thank you for your attention.